In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. There's a story that's traditionally told about the history of Britain from the end of the Roman period in the early 5th century through to the arrival of the Vikings at the end of the 8th century. And it's a story of coalescing kingdoms that led inexorably towards the rise of Wessex as the last man standing. However, according to Thomas Williams, the author of a new book on the era, the story is far more complicated than that. David Musgrove put in a call to Thomas to find out more.
So today I am joined by Thomas Williams, who has written an excellent new book called Lost Realms, Histories of Britain from the Romans to the Vikings. Thomas, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure. Really good to have you. So I very much enjoyed the book. It puts a kind of a different spin on the story of Britain between the end of the Roman period and the start of the Viking era. So that's kind of from the early 5th century through to the end of the 8th. And what's interesting about your book is, I guess, the subtitle, Histories rather than History. So you're trying to tell lots of disparate stories, I suppose, about what was going on during that period.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's something I actually fought with my publisher for that particular subtitle, because really, really key that the traditional way of understanding this period is to see it through the lens of very particular kingdoms that came out the other end in a powerful and strong position, and the way that then feeds into later narratives of British history. But I wanted to emphasize that's only one story that you can tell about this period. There are actually lots and lots of others that often get overlooked. So that's a really key aspect of what the book's all about.
Yeah, and I found that very interesting. So could you give us a little bit of a sense of the kind of standard narrative, this simplistic single line approach that you've just cited there? What have people traditionally thought about the way the narrative progresses?
Sure. Okay, so sort of the generally accepted story of those centuries would begin with the collapse of the Roman Empire, traditionally dated to 410 AD. And that's seen in terms of a fairly precipitous economic and social collapse that's really compounded by waves of Germanic, in inverted commas, migrants crossing the North Sea in the absence of the Roman military who've left the island. And taking over large swathes of southern Britain, driving the indigenous Britons out of their lands and into the highlands of Wales and the north of England in particular. This progresses to a situation where you have what become known as Anglo-Saxons in what is now England, Britons everywhere else. And these Anglo-Saxons then coalesce into kingdoms, the big players being Wessex in the southwest, Mercia in the Midlands, Northumbria in the northeast, East Anglia in East Anglia, and a number of other slightly smaller players. These kingdoms then sort of fight amongst themselves for supremacy over the rest of the Britain, the rest of the island of Britain and with the Britons until eventually the Viking era begins and the whole thing gets thrown up in the air again, with ultimately Wessex coming out as the only power standing. And then the rest of English history sort of flows on from that triumph of King Alfred over the Vikings and everything that follows on from that. So that in a nutshell is sort of how the period is generally understood. What I've omitted from that, of course, is the Christian dimension. And the way that is typically seen is that the migration brought a non-Christian people, a non-Christian Germanic people, into the island of Britain, subsequently to be converted from the year 597, when Augustine's mission from Rome arrives in Kent to evangelize the heathen English. The English then get Christianity really quickly. They get the right kind of Christianity, and then they spread that idea through the rest of Britain as well. So there's a sort of a divine mandate to the progress of English history as well that develops from it. So you can sort of get a sense from this, and this is an extremely simplified version of a very simplified narrative, that the whole thing is extremely Anglo-centric and driven with a sort of an underpinning of Christian myth-making as well.
So that's really, it's a very neat and tidy approach though, isn't it? It all funnels nicely into Alfredian Wessex, and then on we go into sort of a Whiggish view of history, I suppose. So it makes sense, doesn't it? That's a good narrative to follow. Now, look, before we go and sort of dissect that a bit, I need to pick you up on a few things. You said the right sort of Christianity for the English. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, this is an idea that we really, really get from the Northumbrian monk Bede, who writes his ecclesiastical history of the English people in around about 730 AD. And he sees very much the Christianity of the Britons, the native British, the Romano-British, as being substandard in a number of ways, or sort of borderline heretical. In particular, he thinks the monks do their tonsures in the wrong way, which is really, really bad in Bede's opinion. They calculate the date of Easter in the wrong way, again, in Bede's opinion. And these are big issues of their time. They seem fairly trivial from our perspective, but for writers like Bede, they were important. But the Christianity that was delivered to the English was a sort of papally sanctioned Roman version, the authorized version of Christianity. So he very much draws a distinction between the sort of right sort of Christianity that the English are receiving from Rome, and this sort of degenerate, backward, weird, jumbled form of Christianity that was encountered on the island already. It's a horribly sort of prejudiced idea of how things were.
Okay, so we clarified that point. You also used the phrase Anglo-Saxons. I know in your book you try not to do that, and you explain why. Do you want to just give us your take on that contentious phrase?
Yeah. Now, okay. So this is a thorny issue, and it bleeds into modern politics in a number of different directions. But I think the problem with it for this period, the particularly the earlier half of the period, that 400 to 600 bracket, is that nobody at that point in time would have imagined themselves to be an Anglo-Saxon. I think basically nobody ever really imagined themselves to be an Anglo-Saxon. That's a back projection, and it rather implies a uniform ethnic identity for the communities that were developing in southern Britain over the course of this period. It's a prejudicial judgment, if you like. If we decide they're Anglo-Saxons before we've actually thought about the processes that created these new kingdoms or realms, then we've sort of jumped ahead of ourselves, if you like. Yes, there were almost certainly people from Saxony, people from Anglia, but there were also people from Frisia and southern Scandinavia, and probably several other places as well. And of course, there were also native Britons who remained in southern Britain and weren't all driven away. So the idea that we can sort of unproblematically label everybody who's left as an Anglo-Saxon is misleading. So on that basis alone, I think it makes sense to try to avoid using the term as much as possible. It isn't possible all of the time because it's so embedded in the academic literature and the way that we label types of artifacts and so on. But I think it makes sense intellectually to get away from it where it's possible to do so.
Okay, good. And then you also mentioned that the fact that the key playing kingdoms of the story, Wessex, Mercia, Northumbria, and East Anglia, these big sort of fairly famous entities. If anyone's familiar with the period of the story at all, they will know of those kingdoms. Why do they suck up all the oxygen of the story? What gives them the power that other kingdoms don't have?
Yeah, well, they're the bullies, basically. You know, they're the playground bullies of the Dark Ages. They are responsible, effectively, for hoovering up a lot of these smaller realms. That's one aspect of the stories that are told in my book. Often by naked aggression, sometimes by sort of sleight of hand, almost. What that means is they have a longer-lived footprint, which enables them to really control the narrative. So when we do start to get decent written sources appearing from Bede onwards, really, from the mid-8th century or early 8th century onward, they are written within kingdoms that have already lasted a good long time. And so the stories that are told are the stories of these realms. So the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, for example, is produced at the court of King Alfred in its earliest form. It may use material that's older than that, of course, but it's a West Saxon product. As I say, Bede is a Northumbrian monk. He's writing very much from a Northumbrian perspective. So that really fossilizes the idea that these are the important parts of the country as the history develops.
But what you're saying in your book, which is really interesting, is the fact that actually there were lots of other kingdoms and realms and political entities that existed during this period, which are kind of overlooked, and some have been, you know, almost completely lost to our understanding. Others are a bit more famous, but you're saying it was a lot more complicated than just these four kingdoms.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one thing I didn't say is that there's a lot of luck involved in this. You know, a kingdom like the Kingdom of Essex, for example, which at its height comprised not just the county of Essex in eastern England, but also Middlesex, which is the county that includes the city of London, parts of Surrey to the south, parts of Hertfordshire to the north. And so in purely geographical terms, Essex was a decent-sized player, but it also had access to this enormously important symbolic heart in the Roman city of Londinium. It had coastal trading links across the North Sea, it had access into the centre of Britain up the Thames, and so it had all the tools really available to it to become one of these big powers. But the fact that it didn't and why it didn't, I think, is something that the book explores. But it's also worth thinking about that it's not alone in terms of being a kingdom that had potential that didn't quite make it. So if we just sort of shift our perspective a little bit, you can think about how the ultimate shape of Britain as a whole could have been very different were it not for a few fairly random factors at times.
Yeah. Okay. Now, so I'm guessing that to study these small lost realms that you have done is a bit of a tricky business in terms of sources available. If, as you say, like kind of, you know, the sources tend to be a bit later when they come in, and they would be aligned towards the bigger kingdoms that have already established themselves. So how hard is it to get into the story of these places?
Yeah, it's not easy at all. I mean, I wouldn't say I underestimated it when I started writing the book, but it was certainly a challenging book to write. And you know, one of the reasons that we call, some of us persist in calling this period the Dark Ages is that really, certainly for the first two centuries, the fifth and sixth centuries, there is almost no contemporary historical source to guide us whatsoever. So as far as sort of difficult and obscure periods of British history go, there are few that are more obscure than those two centuries. All we really have to guide us here is a sermon written by a Welsh monk called Gildas, who sets the groundwork really for that standard narrative of Germanic conquest that I laid out at the beginning, because he wasn't trying to write an objective history anyway, and he was writing probably the late 5th, maybe very early 6th century, but he was writing a sermon excoriating the rulers and ecclesiastical leaders of his own day for being bad Christians, and using this as almost as a parable of what happens if you're not a good Christian. You know, these these rotters from overseas will come in and, you know, sack your cities. But so much has then been built on that story. But I mean, largely speaking, that's it. I mean, in terms of sort of narrative stuff that we've got, that's it for practically two centuries. What we have to go on then is the material that accrues to these places later on, and also the archaeology, of course. And the archaeology is absolutely crucial for making any sense. And in some ways, it's the archaeology that gives the lie to a lot of that standard narrative.
And when you say archaeology, you don't just mean specific sites and artifacts that have been dug up. You're also ploughing landscape archaeology as well, to try and that discipline of looking at the bigger picture and trying to see what the likes of field boundaries and that sort of thing can tell us about the story, right?
Yeah, I mean, up to a point. I mean, sadly, what we don't have for this period are things like charter bounds, which would be wonderful. We have those for later early medieval history in Britain. We can actually plot, you know, the administrative layout of political units. There's a certain amount that you can back project from those, because we can assume that some of these regions, although they don't appear in contemporary sources, the way they appear later on are probably fossilized from an earlier age. So things like diocesan boundaries, those bishoprics were established possibly in the 7th century and are unlikely to have changed in very substantial ways. And so where you have something like the Kingdom of Huiche, for example, where the bishop was installed in the 7th century, when we then have the diocesan boundaries written down later on, we can largely assume that those boundaries correspond roughly to the kingdom of the same name. It's not a perfect method, clearly, but it's often all we have to go on. There are a few scraps as well, like documents like the tribal hidage, which is probably a tribute. It's probably a document designed to calculate the amount of tribute that an overlord could generate from Britain. And it was probably produced in either Mercia or Northumbria. And it lists kingdoms and tribal groups alongside a figure that denotes the number of hides each one possesses, a hide being a unit of land that notionally could support a single homestead, farmstead. So it's the economic potential of a region, basically. And these range from, you know, many thousands for the bigger kingdoms down to a few hundred for some of the small fry. And many of the names on that list, some of them appear in the book as kingdoms, but many others are simply just names on a list with a number. You know, we don't even really know where they were at all. Now, that's very useful because it gives us a sense of sort of relative heft, if you like, economic heft in the period that the document was written, which is 8th century, I think is probably where we should locate it. But it just also has a geographical sense to how it's organized. So, for example, again, the Elmet Setna, the Elmet dwellers, the kingdom of Elmet being one of those that I've written about, is situated between the Pek Setna, the people of the Peak District, and the people of Lindsay in North Lincolnshire. So from that alone, we can sort of work out roughly where they were, somewhere, you know, West Riding of Yorkshire.
So a good opportunity for a bit of detective work, but quite hard to work out where you're at. Now, okay, so let's dip into a couple of these kingdoms that you talk about. We're not going to go through all of them because you talk about quite a few interesting places and people need to read the book to get chapter and verse on that. But let's just pick a couple and just talk a little bit about them. So you mentioned Huiche. Is that the pronunciation, Huiche?
Oh, yes. No one really knows, I think, is the honest answer to that. It's Huiche or Huiche, something along those lines. But the origins of the term itself are a bit vexed. So, you know, whether it comes from Welsh or whether it comes from Old English, there's not really any consensus around that. And the pronunciation probably would be different depending on which way you go with it. Okay, let's stick with that.
Okay, spelling wise, Huicce is the spelling, and that's I'm sat here on the border of Gloucestershire, right in North Wiltshire. So I think we're not too far away, perhaps from the boundaries of that area. And I think this is where you kind of grew up, somewhere around this area. So this one's quite close to home. So introduce us to this kingdom and what happened to it.
Sure. So the Kingdom of Huiche. As I've already mentioned, we kind of have a sense of its proportions from the later diocese. that was formed for the bishops of Wiltshire. Core territory is the county of Gloucestershire and the county of Worcestershire. It did also incorporate bits of Warwickshire as well, and possibly some bits of North Wiltshire. So you may even have, you know, be in sort of the ancient kingdom of Wiltshire now, at least until the West Saxons kind of stamped their authority on that corner of it. So it's very much a kingdom sort of defined by the River Severn and its floodplain, the Vale of Evesham, and the Cotswold Hills running south to north. Now, what's interesting about that area, and I should say the Wychwood Forest, which takes its name from the kingdom, Wiltshire, which is just off to the east on the edge of Oxfordshire, and probably formed the boundary of the kingdom on that side. And what's really interesting about this region, certainly the southern part of it, is that it was one of the most prosperous and developed parts of Roman Britain. So there's fabulous archaeology from Cirencester, Gloucester, Bath, demonstrating the enormous wealth and economic sophistication of those urban centres in the Roman period, but also some wonderful villas that have been excavated at places like Woodchester, for example, with extraordinary mosaic floors and underfloor heating, you know, hypocausts and the full sort of elaboration of Roman aristocratic country living. So how we go from that picture to what we find later on, which is an apparently Anglo-Saxon, in inverted commas, kingdom, very much under Mercian overlordship, is a difficult but quite compelling bit of detective work.
And when does this kingdom sort of start to fade out of the record? Then
we start to lose it. Well, it's an interesting thing because it almost starts to dwindle the moment we start to see it. The first king we know of, we've got a few names who apparently belong to a Wychian royal family, but the first sort of substantive king that we know of is a chap called Osric, who's remembered as the founder of Gloucester Cathedral. And he's recognised as being a king, a full king in his own right. But each successive generation, as they're named in charters produced in Wiltshire and also in Mercia, these kings become progressively lesser in authority relative to the Mercians. So they start to be called subregulus, little under kings. Eventually, they're demoted to dux, you know, the origin of the modern duke. I think one of the last kings of Wiltshire is afforded a certain degree of rule over his own people, which is a really ambiguous phrase. So this is
doesn't
a constant,
sound good.
I know, it's a sort of thin gruel, isn't it? So it's a whittling away of Wiltshire authority, which really by the mid 8th century, it has effectively gone entirely, and it becomes a province of Mercia and the Mercian, the wider Mercian realm, which is expanding rampantly all over southern Britain at that point.
Okay. What about, I mean, you mentioned Elmet earlier. What about that one? Tell us about that place.
So again, I mean, Elmet is one of those that we see it at its moment of disillusion. The only certain king we know of, a King Ceredig of Elmet, we meet in Bede's history, being driven out effectively, or rather, no. I should correct myself there. It's not Bede doesn't actually tell that story exactly. He tells the story that leads up to these events, but the Historia Brittonum, the ninth century Welsh source, describes King Ceredig being driven out of his kingdom and later dying. So we see Elmet sort of snuffed out in the sort of the power politics that are taking place around Northumbrian and East Anglian sort of machinations, diplomatic machinations. So everything we really know about it has to be pulled together from very disparate bits of source material. Place names give us an indication of its sort of eastern boundaries. And there are some fabulous Welsh poetic references to the kingdom. The one other thing that we know about King Ceredig is that he was remembered as the son of a chap called Gwalog, And Gwalog was remembered as a very serious player in British politics in general. You know, the praise poems that were written for him describe him as being the lawgiver of Elmet, which people have interpreted as meaning that he was at least an overlord, if not a king, of this realm. So although the sources are very difficult and the poetry may or may not date to the time that it purports to, it was certainly remembered that people from this central region, the southern Pennine region, once wielded a significant amount of clout, but we only see it when it's failing.
Hmm. And for our listeners who aren't familiar with British geography, so the southern Pennines now is firmly in England. It's a bit of England. Is this an Anglo-Saxon kingdom, for want of a better word, mindful of what you said earlier, or is this a British kingdom?
Oh, no, this is a good point to clarify. All the evidence we have indicates that this was a British realm, by which I mean a region that was inhabited by people who spoke a Brittonic Celtic language and whose customs and personal names were British in that sense. We get a bit of a flavour of this from some of the place names that have survived, which are Old English place names. So they're names that were coined by an incoming group who spoke a different language. And they named a number of places as in relation to the words, their words for Welsh or Britain. So I think of any good examples, but certainly the elements, the place name elements are derived from the Old English words Weyl, which means foreigner, or Cymru, which is the self-designation of Britons for themselves. So it was certainly seen from an outside perspective as a place where Britons lived, and that's significant.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And that's an aspect of Dark Age Britain that I think people often lose sight of. It's seen as sort of a period of just pure chaos and turmoil and barbarism and, you know, mud huts and savageness. But that's not the picture we get from somewhere like Dunonia at all.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Do you want to pick one more of the sort of the realms that you talk about? One of your, I don't know, your favourite one, or just one that you think is particularly interesting? I like Dumnonia.
I think Dumnonia is quite unique, actually. It illustrates some things that are perhaps unusual. I mean, in particular, given that during the Roman period, it was one of the least Romanised corners of Britain, in good stark contrast to Wiltshire, for example, which isn't a million miles away.
We should clarify, where is Dumnonia?
Dumnonia, yes, sorry, I should say. Dumnonia is the effectively now the counties of Cornwall and Devon. So it's that southwest peninsula that sticks out like a tail from the bottom of the island. And as I say, in stark contrast to Wiltshire, Dumnonia becomes one of the most sophisticated and apparently Roman corners in a period that is, you know, generally perceived to be not at all Roman, by which I mean we find large quantities of imported Mediterranean pottery, you know, fine tableware, at sites like Tintagel. We find amphorae that almost certainly contain wine and olive oil, in again very large quantities. There seems to have been a ready adoption of Roman forms of Christianity from the iconography and the types of saints who are being venerated in the peninsula, that is unusual for the rest of southern Britain at this period, most certainly, in the 6th century. And so what we see there is a community who were very self-consciously, it would seem, wanting to associate themselves with the memory, or not even the memory, the ongoing reality of the Roman Empire as it still existed in the Eastern Mediterranean, and forging real-time connections with the rest of southern Europe. And that's an aspect of Dark Age Britain that I think people often lose sight of. It's seen as sort of a period of just pure kind of chaos and turmoil and barbarism and, you know, mud huts and savageness. But that's not the picture we get from somewhere like Dumnonia at all. And we can get glimmers of that from elsewhere along that western seaboard as well.
And you make the good point in the book, don't you, that though we imagine that the Western Roman Empire was riven by catastrophe in the start of the 5th century and was all sorts of terrible things going on, the Eastern Roman Empire was still a going concern and had all the trappings of civilization still cracking on, and Dumnonia was able to hook into that, it appears.
Exactly, and I think, you know, that realization that Constantinople remained this beacon of, by contrast to what was going on in Western Europe at the time, extraordinary wealth and civilization in its literal sense, must have been an enormous stimulus to the imagination and the aspirations and ambitions of rulers across the West. It's just amazing that we can actually see it tangibly in somewhere like Dumnonia, which is one of the furthest flung corners. And as I say, you know, formerly one of the least Roman.
So that's a tour of just a few of the kingdoms you talk about. So what you're doing basically is you're complicating the picture. You're explaining that there's lots of different things going on, lots of different experiences for people through this period, the Dark Ages, as you've talked about. It's a much more complicated picture than we imagine. Can we sort of bring it back together again and simplify things a bit? Is there a theme in the way these kingdoms, these realms die off? Do they all get swallowed up by their bigger neighbours in the same sort of way?
Sort of depressingly, I think that is a big part of the story. That is an undeniable aspect to it, that it is the most aggressive, the most predatory, the most willing to use force that survive the longest. But in terms of the detail of how these kingdoms develop, the identities that they form, the complexities of that pathfinding exercise out of the collapse of a Roman Britain and towards something else, there really isn't an overarching narrative that you can knit together. And in a way, that is the main message I think the book seeks to convey, that we can't just impose a one-size-fits-all storyline onto this period. It's lots of people working together and against each other to try to find some sort of new world, some new way of doing business. And they find all sorts of different solutions. Some of them work, some of them don't work at all. Others end up a messy compromise. But what we see by the later Anglo-Saxon period, when we can start to call it an Anglo-Saxon period, is a rationalization and a development of these sort of much more monolithic identities that override a lot of the regional differences and the untidiness and the messiness of the process that had got them there.
Does these disparate narratives tell us anything about the sort of the perceived ethnic identities of people in Britain at the time? When I've talked on a podcast about this topic before, experts have kind of said, well, ethnicity is kind of a bit of a modern construct, and we get a bit hung up about it, and we should not worry about it so much. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true to a certain extent. Although, having said that, you know, it's undeniable that Bede drew very stark boundaries between the English and the British, and his narrative is founded around that split, and arguably, It's that narrative written in the 8th century that set the tone for much of the division within Britain that continues to this day. The way that people think of themselves as either being English or being Celtic, in inverted commas. It's a difficult one. I think what I would say is, whilst ethnicity in the way we think of it now probably didn't exist, people did have a draw to finding a sense of identity, which isn't exactly the same thing. And they were pulling together scraps scraps of tradition or of memory or of mythology to build something new. And it could be very local. As I said a moment ago, I think that the development of these much bigger kind of super regional identities is something that comes later on. It overrides a lot of these localized identities. But what we see in the burial archaeology, for example, is an extraordinary sort of mishmash of different themes and imagery. You know, something like the Prittlewell tomb from near Southend, or even the more famous Sutton Hoo Mound One burial, is an amazing kind of kaleidoscope of objects and images from the late Roman Empire, the North Sea world, the Baltic, the Eastern Mediterranean, the Frankish worlds, from Ireland, from the west of Britain, brought together in these extremely elaborate mounds to assemble a sense of a new identity, which pulls in all sorts of different directions. And I think that's going on everywhere. It's just the exact balance that perhaps differs from one place to the next.
Okay, that's a good way of looking at it. So I'm willing to bet that a lot of our listeners, and I'm sure I'll get some emails if I'm wrong, won't have heard of the likes of Elmet and Hwiche. You know, those will be new names to them. But do those realms, do those lost kingdoms still resonate or echo in any way today? Can we still find any evidence of these identities that you talked about? Do they still have any value, any power?
Oh, absolutely. I think they really do. I mean, sometimes it's quite obvious. You know, the Kingdom of Essex retains its name in the County of Essex, and I'm sure there are many people from Essex who feel a very strong attachment to that sense of a deep rooted history that goes back to the very dawn of that period of English ethnogenesis, if you like. Likewise, in Sussex, the Kingdom of Sussex became the two counties of Sussex. I suppose the same is sort of true for Powys in East Wales, although modern Powys isn't exactly where the original Kingdom of Powys necessarily was. But still, the name has a resonance and a history to it. I think there are more hidden... there's a more hidden sort of echoes of some of these kingdoms as well. I mean, I think of the very independent streak of Cornwall, for example, which, you know, many Cornish people don't regard themselves as in any way English, and only uneasily fit within the sort of political boundaries of the United Kingdom. And that has its roots going back to the Kingdom of Dumnonia, although Devon was much more thoroughly anglicised. Cornwall held out for longer and retains that distinctiveness. I think others, not so much. The Kingdom of Reged has left very little trace of itself. We're not really even sure exactly where it was. But in other ways that are less obvious, I think the geography itself defines some of these regions in ways that are still hard to deny. So North Lincolnshire, for example, was a kingdom, the Kingdom of Lindsay, which was cut off by marshes, fens, the sea, to form almost an island of its own. And there's still a quality, although the fens have been drained, there's still a sense in which that part of the country has a distinctive geographical separateness to some of the regions around it. And likewise, Hwiche, again, which is very much a sort of a valley depression surrounded by, you know, the Cotswolds and the Malvern Hills. So you can really see in the landscape the shape of it still imprinted there.
Excellent. Well, I'm soon to be walking the Cotswold Way, which I think goes through the territory of the Hwiche. So I'll see if I can find any evidence of them as I go down there.
Oh yeah, excellent.
Now, look, to finish up, just a silly little question to finish. So kind of these kingdoms are kind of the underdogs, aren't they? They're the little guys that disappear versus, you know, the might of Wessex and Mercia. Did you write about them because you side with the underdogs? What are you trying to achieve with this book?
Do you know what? There's a part of me that does. There's a part of me that gets tired of hearing about, you know, how great Alfred was and the myth-making that was spun about his ancestors that give rise to this notion of inevitability about the way that history progressed. And I think, well, okay, fine. But what about the Kingdom of Sussex? What was happening there? So the thing is that gets forgotten is that just because Bede didn't write very much about Sussex didn't mean that nothing was happening in Sussex for all of those centuries. Something was, and that deserves our attention just as much as what was happening in Jarrow or in Winchester. So yes, part of it is that. Part of it is just sort of feeling aggrieved for these little kingdoms that just don't get the time of day. But it's also there's also a broader point to make, and that's about how we tell history and what we're trying to do with writing history in the first place. And I think too often we can fall into the trap of back projecting from where we are to find stories that make sense of that and ignoring the failed experiments and the wrong turns and the missed opportunities. But to get a real understanding of history, you've got to look at the things that didn't work out as well as the things that did. And so it's making that case as well.
Brilliant. Well, Thomas Williams, thank you very much for your time. Lost Realms, Histories of Britain from the Romans to the Vikings is published now. And as I said, it's a great read. So do go and check it out and have a read. Thomas, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Thomas Williams. His book, Lost Realms, Histories of Britain from the Romans to the Vikings, is out now. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt.